This is the Liminalista podcast between autoculture.com, Jason Horsey talking again to Anonymous Italian. You said you've got things that have been coming up, but I don't know if you want to start with that.
Well, yeah, we could definitely start there, but what's been going on in your life?
Well, you know, I don't do that. I'm hopeless at that catch-up. Like, I just have to stay in the moment, otherwise I get lost.
All right, well, that's what's going on in your life then, right?
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, I started... I think I had mentioned to you that I started seeing a new therapist.
Yeah, you did in the email, and that she had been recommended, or she was associated with Colin. What's his name? Ross. Colin Ross.
Ross. And she did some work with him in the 80s, and I guess it lasted. Like, I guess he came to Texas, where she was running a mobile unit, and they brought him in because they did. This is all secondhand information because I don't remember everything, but they really didn't understand what the hell they were dealing with. And according to her, he was helpful in that situation. But on beyond that, this is actually the first time where I've dealt with a therapist personally that really, really understands a lot of the stuff that I've experienced, because she's just seen it so many times.
Right.
Whereas my other therapists, they cared and they were good therapists, but they couldn't completely wrap their heads around the situation, which I think is the most interesting part of it to me out of all of it.
What, head wrapping?
Head wrapping? just about how many therapists may be ill prepared to deal with this type of thing.
Absolutely,
you know?
Yeah.
And I can't say that I'm just not saying this to be polite. They were therapists, they gave a shit about what they did. They were actually genuinely working at helping people, but after it got to a certain point, it was like a loss.
So when you say they, you're talking about one, you're using the polite gender-neutral pronoun, or are you talking about more than one?
Oh, there was just more than one therapist that really didn't, you know, after a while in my process of trying to work with all this, they just did not have the background to deal with it.
Yeah.
Which I find that says a lot to me.
And how did, I know this came out in email, but refresh my memory, how did you find this current therapist?
I basically did some, you know, searching on the internet, trying to find something with, you know, with the therapist that actually deals with dissociative disorders, and her name came up. She was local, and lo and behold, she had a pretty decent background.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And how long have you been seeing her?
It's been about 2 months.
Like weekly?
I try to get there weekly, but her schedule is so full that, and the way my schedule falls, it's been kind of difficult to get there weekly. But my schedule's changing, so I should be able to actually get there weekly at least for a while.
And is it standard rates, or is she giving a special deal, or what's the financial?
She does a sliding scale, but I have insurance, so.
Oh, I could get it on insurance, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Huh, that's nice.
Yeah, there's still some of that left in America, you know, where your insurance actually works for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't think, or I didn't know that it covered therapeutic costs ever. Because I know it doesn't cover dental, so.
Yeah, some of them do, some of them don't. Like, there's some people, like, I have a small dental plan with the job that I have. It's decent. And then with therapy, you have to go through basically, they have to find out what it's for. You know, there's certain things they allow and certain things that they don't.
And you, were you familiar with Colin Ross before meeting this therapist?
I did some reading about him. I watched a couple of his videos. I've watched a couple of videos about by other people. But it's like a real deep, thorough, you know, thorough information. You know, it's like a couple of his videos here and there, but nothing very thorough.
Yeah, he's been around for a while. I mean, I first heard about him on the that Canadian radio si series on mind control. It was in the 90s, I think, but I just heard those audios and started hearing those audios about a couple of years ago, and I think that was the first time I'd heard of Colin Ross, and my first impression was very good. But I did, there were a couple of things that were a bit red flag to me, like he was saying, you can't blame the CIA for this, it's the psychiatric community that's responsible. I thought, what? So I remember that, and I think there was another one, I'm not sure what it was. But then I noticed, or I found out over time, that there's generally some suspicion within the survivor community, and specifically at Rigorous Intuition, what had come up, one survivor there had wrote about how in one of Colin Ross's books he'd put this weird code.
Really?
Yeah, and it was just sort of hanging there at the front of the book, like some, I mean, it wasn't a, like a, ISBN or anything like that. It was part of what the book he'd written, but it was just this weird coded message, and they thought it was there to trigger, and they're saying he's not to be trusted. And then when I spoke to Alison Miller, not on the podcast but off the record, she said that she that he was not to be trusted, that he was part of the whatever, you know, the I guess honeypotting would be the simplest way of putting it.
Right.
But anyway, we're not here to level accusations. I don't know, is obviously the bottom line, but just that there's definitely suspicions about him. Like, he's definitely seen as that way by many people in the survivor community, such as it is. So I just thought I'd mention that, seeing as his name came up. That's all. But bringing it back to your therapist. Well, I guess what I mean, what was her association with Ross, first of all, before we get to your experience? But let's just sort of check a bit of the credentials a little bit more, maybe.
Well, I mean, her thing, like in a nutshell, with Ross was she was in Texas running a mobile crisis unit, and they were getting so many of the same types of behavior from people from all different places, they were getting to the point like, what the hell are we going to do with this?
Right.
And her experience level was not where it could have been when dealing with all the disassociation and the stories and the multiple personalities and the commonalities of the abuse report, the abuse reported or the ritualistic aspect. And she's like, what am I going to do? She got in touch with him, and they worked out something where he came there and lent his services to try to bring continuity to everything. And I guess he stayed for a couple weeks, and she was happy for the experience, and that was about it.
Oh, okay. So he was just the go-to guy who just came in and gave them some debriefing. Okay, so that's
Particularly as a consultant.
yeah.
And I guess from her end, it was very helpful because she was basically in what the fuck mode. You know, what am I going to do? You know, and it was pretty extreme to where it was just case after case after case. And of course, it was in the 80s and when this stuff seemed to be spiking, you know.
Oh, so she's been doing it for that long then.
Yeah, she's been at this a long time.
25 years or something.
Yeah.
And Okay, so without mentioning where you are, you're in a fairly heavily populated area. You're saying that she has an enormous client base. Is it exclusively victims of organized abuse, or does it include domestic?
I think she does some of the organized abuse thing. I think she does just regular counseling. But one of her specialties is dissociative disorders. So that's part of her, you know, what she hangs on her shingle.
And does she make a direct correlation between dissociative identity disorder and organized abuse, or does she see it as extending into ordinary abuse?
She makes a direct correlation.
Yeah. Same with Alison Miller. I mean, I think quite a lot of researchers do say that if you have dissociative identity disorder, then it was organized. That's their viewpoint. I mean, that's a common viewpoint, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she agrees that, like, disassociation could happen in a number of ways, but one of the ways that it does occur is through organized and or ritual abuse.
All right, so well, that's a little bit different then, because I mean, obviously dissociation is different from dissociative identity disorder, but what I was saying is that, okay, rightly or wrongly, what some of these researchers, including Alison Miller, I believe, says is that if it's actual DID, as in multiple personality, then it's a result of organized abuse, as in that doesn't happen just through ordinary dissociation from trauma. Whether it's true or not, I don't know, but I
might have misunderstood you. So yeah, she's basically saying the same thing as Alison Miller.
Okay. And so what's what did you want to talk about? Things that have come up with her, or where did you want to go with that?
I don't think it's, I guess it's some things that have come up with her, but I think it's more about my own perspective. And for me, it's a huge eye opener. For other people, it may not be.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the way I understood disassociation, because I did so much of that work on my own, but once I started working with a therapist that had experience and tools to work with it, For the longest time, I understand, and I might need to be corrected on this, that when you experience disassociation or dissociative identity disorder, it could happen because someone is trying to protect themselves from these extreme emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, there'll be people that could manipulate somebody else into developing another personality, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the big eye-opener for me was I was disassociating from a part of myself as opposed to just disassociating from the extreme level of emotions that I was feeling.
Okay, so I mean that's quite a subtle distinction, like, because the things we experience are parts of us, and they become it. So, can you clarify what you mean there?
I believe I can. I'm going to do my best. It was almost as if I disassociated from a very, very big part of myself as a child. Like the person that I naturally was as a child, I disassociated from that. So I had to develop another personality to survive.
So is it possible that what you're talking about is dissociating from your body, or at least in part?
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, obviously we're talking about concepts that are very ephemeral, as in the self itself is an ephemeral concept. So you talk about parts of the self and so on. The body obviously isn't ephemeral. But it's unclear. It's difficult to understand for all of us, like what you're talking about, as in if we dissociate into this constructed identity self, let's say, or this false self that is disconnected from the greater part of us. We don't experience that as not having a body. Obviously, we still feel as though we are our body, and yet we are disconnected from our body, I would say, in the sense that we're not in tune with it. We're not experiencing life at a sensory level. You know, we're not aware of the sensations and very dimly aware, let's say, like looking through the wrong end of a telescope kind of awareness.
Right.
So,
and
go
ahead.
Well, I was just trying to finish my interpretation of what you said, so that the greater part of who we are, you're saying you got disconnected from the greater part of who you were as a child.
Yes.
That's right. Yes. And I'm just questioning, you know, how much you see that as correlating with being disconnected from your body. Is that the whole thing, or is that part of what you're describing, or what do you think?
I believe that it is part of what I'm, like, disconnecting from my body at that time was part of the experience. And as for the longest time, I understand that, like, these extreme emotions, we're trying to protect ourselves from these extreme emotions that we feel by disassociation, or to protect ourselves from a trauma that we feel. Mm-hmm. And I understand that that was part of it, but a big eye opener for me was I was disassociating from a part of myself, just who I naturally was.
And how did you, or what was this eye-opening experience like? I mean, was it a mental realization, or was it that you became aware of this part of yourself that you had disconnected from?
It was a mental eye-opener. There was emotions attached to it because I dealt with a lot of grief about it for all the years that I fought with who I was, you know, and I fought with having a sense that who I really was there, but it was like I didn't have access to it. And all the years that I struggled with that, it was very difficult. So it caused a lot of grief for me.
Right. And the grief, I mean, experiencing the grief is like getting back in touch with the part of you that's grieving.
Exactly. Yep.
Because, I mean, when I said at the beginning, well, you can't necessarily make a distinction between emotions that we didn't want to feel and the part of ourselves we cut off from, as in, you know, not that we're made of emotions exactly, but if we want to cut off from intense feelings, we have to shut down the part that feels. It's not just that we're compartmentalizing those feelings. We're actually disconnecting from the part that's able to feel grief at all, never mind, you know, one particular incident of it. Right. So I think that's what I'm getting from what you're saying, is that you're recognizing that you shut down, you know, disconnected or dissociated from certain basic capacities in you to feel and experience life.
Yes. And to take action and to make my own thoughts and to have my own perceptions. It was like that all got cut off.
Yeah. So, but you know, based on our last two conversations, it seemed like you were aware of that when we talked before, so I'm still not clear what's come into awareness that's new.
Well, I mean, I was definitely aware of it, but the difference was, is every day, and again, it's like whoever will be listening to this and you, if I'm stumbling, if I'm not finding the right words, I appreciate the patience that is given here. For me, every day has been this questioning process that I do to myself. Is this really me? How I'm acting, thinking, feeling, and my perceptions, are they me, or is it something I'm just creating to make myself feel better or to feel what I consider normal? So it felt like I had this part of me inside of me that was really me, but I was taught not to trust it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no, you know, no, Chris, there's like a voice saying, no, Chris, this is the real you, just trust who it is. But somebody taught me not to trust that.
Right. So was it the result of talking to this person and her describing things to you, or was it something else that helped you to recognize this?
I think a lot of it was her allowing me to speak on my experience and her providing validation that these types of things happen to people in this realm a lot.
In this realm, as in the world of organized abuse, or what?
In the realm of organized abuse, in the realm of pedophile rings, in the realm of ritual abuse. It seems that somehow these people are able to have a skill where they're able to not erase per se, but to shut off a part of a person's personality so they cannot react in a way that these people don't want them to react.
Well, I think I would question your use of language there. I mean, I don't necessarily want to get into semantics. It might not be helpful, but on the other hand, it is one of the things I do. And I would say you're talking about not the personality's ability to react, but the psyche's ability to respond to its environment. Now, it might seem like hair splitting, but in the field that we're talking about, it's not, because actually what you're talking about is the creation of personalities, fake personalities that can only react. They can't respond.
But see, this is why I like talking to you, because you are able to put a much better description on it and get much more exact than I can.
And I think that that could just be, you know, a semantic thing, an intellectual ability, in which case it would be kind of worthless. But I think it's a sort of microcosm of what we're talking about here, because like, as far as you're in the personality that can only react and can't respond, there wouldn't be any difference between, you know, what you said and what I said. They're like, they're just words, but actually it's all the difference in the world.
I don't think you're making this about arguing semantics at all. I think that's perfect what you're doing.
I know. I wasn't thinking you were. I just was wanting to zero in on how the thing that we were describing actually was a symptom of the thing that we were describing, kind of thing. How it's a it demonstrates the thing that I wanted to bring attention to, which is the thing that you're bringing attention to, which is how we get shut down and how we can't respond from all of us.
Yes.
We can't respond with all of our body and all of our soul. We can just respond from this constructed fragment.
A constructed fragment. Yeah.
So and of course, it's very, you know, when we talk about these things, it can intensify the sense of that limitation, as in, you know, how much can we really talk about this, because we're stuck in the fragment, and we don't want to be, but of course, you can't force, you know, wholeness either.
No.
And I mean, I know from talking to you that you appreciate the opportunity to be more present and emotionally responsive and all that, and that's certainly what therapy is about, and that's what you zeroed in on. But as you know, we also want to talk about the machinery and the, you know, the details and stuff, and that can be helpful too,
right?
And so I'm curious about, with this therapist, you said that she said that this, you know, the way you are is common for people who've ended up in these realms of organized abuse. So is part of what she's helping you with talking about that, as in how these organized abuse rings operate and how they impact the psyche and all that? Is she actually going into that with you?
Yeah, she's going into that more and more over time. I don't think she's trying to dump it all on my plate at once.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it is just her wanting to hear my experiences, and a lot of it is, you know, her, again, giving me validation because she's seen it so many times, you know, about how it, like, for instance, it was no big surprise to her that, you know, the kid that abused all of us was so talented at what he did.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for somebody like me and what I've experienced, that wasn't supposed to be talked about. That wasn't supposed to be discovered, that, you know, this kid had basically, it seemed like he had training at a young age to be able to manipulate people at that high of a level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of stuff like that, and her relating some experiences about how children, you know, create, you know, there was a story that she told about a kid who was maybe like 9 years old, and his other personality was, he called him Satan. Like, his other personality was what he believed to be Satan himself.
Right.
And he actually thought Satan was protecting him. I just can't get me.
If I come to your house, this is one thing you can do for me. If I come to your house, this is one thing you can do for me. Don't bother about making me no coffee. Please give me a cup of hot tea. I done quit drinking altogether, but you know. Come on in my house, lightning. I got everything you may need. Come on in my house. I got everything that you may need. She said, if you get tired of receiving what I give you, then you can take a long pull me. That's what she said.
So Yeah, because I've heard similar things or read about them, and it correlates with some of my own identity games, so I do lend credence to that. How soon did she start telling you stories or experiences that she'd heard from other people? Like how did it proceed in terms of you gave your history, and then at a certain point she was giving you validation and then giving you these other stories or accounts that validated your own experience? Like, how did that proceed? I'm curious, because it's a delicate thing, right?
Yeah, and it very much is. It, you know, like after like about three visits, it started to trickle in. You know, like maybe after the third visit, like she related a specific story about someone, and it was, you know, it was a footnote, and it didn't go into too much detail. You know, and then after another visit, she told me the story about this kid because she wanted to start relating other people's stories in the most safest way possible to help me understand that there are a lot of other people who experience this level of craziness. And it seems like the key factor is if you can get the victim not to believe anything that he or she thinks, feels or experiences, then you got them. You got them beat.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth in that, and much more than just obviously keeping their crimes concealed, but in terms of disassociating the person from their own, what their senses are telling them, so they cease to trust their own senses. That essentially makes us very easy to manipulate. I mean, that's the most basic thing in terms of turning people into robots, really. They have to refer to commands, basically. And the commands can become more and more subtle and built into the culture and so on. But what's occurring to me while talking to you, and, well, I'll just say it, is that getting people to not trust what they not believe what they know. The flip side of that can be getting them to believe versions of their own experience which don't come from themselves, even if they're actually true.
Okay.
So what I mean by that is if, because it seems to me, and I don't, you know, I can't help but end up implying that your therapist could be one of these people. I mean, there's no way for me to avoid that. I'm only implying that in a very general sense, as in you never know. So just,
right.
You should, in my opinion, you should be cautious the whole way down the line. I'm sure you already know this. And without being suspicious in a sort of guarded, defended sense, just suspicious in a healthy, open-minded sense, you don't know. I mean, you could get assigned a handler, right? This is the way they operate. And we do know there's a lot of stories out there that are being told by survivors and by therapists that are not helping.
Right.
Because they're creating a narrative that is not embodied. It's coming through the persona again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what makes what I try to do on this podcast different from all those other podcasts out there that talk about ritual abuse and all the rest of it, and they're just moving from one exciting, scary anecdote to the next, and right, and then they're not taking time to take a breath, and all that grief and all that anguish that's just getting pushed down and pushed down. Still, it's not the way the narrative's being revealed isn't allowing for a real re-experiencing and a gradual integration, which is what therapy is about. So it's just occurring to me, like as I'm talking to you, like one way that a therapist could mislead a survivor and keep them from integrating would be through a kind of validation, and by giving them stories and by giving them a mental level of validation whereby they can say, yeah, this is true, and now I can move on. And they haven't actually gone into the body memories because they've said, well, it's enough for me to just, you know, get the validation, yeah, thumbs up, all this happened. But it's really it's what's in the body, isn't it? As you're saying, the emotions that you weren't able to access and feel.
And you just hit the nail on the head. And again, I'm going to repeat myself, not to be redundant or to be redundant in a positive way. It always goes back to me coming to the table when we talk with a piece of clay that needs to be shaped. And I kind of bring the material and you have the more finer chisel. I mean, and what I mean by that is what you just described is kind of a twofold thing. It's like we all need to watch our back. And like you said, not in a way where you're like, you know, hiding out and being paranoid, but just watching your back about what's going on. And you specifically said something about allowing the emotions to be dealt with. Mm-hmm. Because you have to make it about you. If you're in there to heal, or if I'm in there to heal, the mechanics, like you said, are very, very important, because that provides something people like you need badly, which is context. Because we weren't allowed to have any context, because if we did, then once again, our sense, our response would be there. And that means they would have something to worry about, our abusers. So what I've been doing with this lady is why it was important for you to ask about the process, was it's a gradual thing, because the descriptions are important, the history is important, the strategy, the background stories, all that validation is very important. But the most important thing is the focus being on me, what I felt, what is still trapped there, and what needs to be healed. And that a lot of what needs to be healed is having a safe place to express the emotions that I was never allowed to have access to.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I know that was long-winded, but I think it needed to be.
No, it wasn't. So, I mean, one of the reasons that I was inspired to say the things I said was because what you described so far sounds like your therapist is quite hands-on, let's say. It's an impression I get.
Meaning what? Like, if you could just go in a little bit more detail.
Well, let's say it's a spectrum, and a hands-off therapist would be one. Like, there's a thing called clean language.
Right.
Have you heard about it?
Never heard of that one.
Okay. And essentially, clean language, the therapist is very restricted to a group of questions that he or she isn't even allowed to alter the phrasing on. So, for example, if you say there's all this emotion, you know, coming up, then the therapist can say, what kind of emotion is that? Or what's that emotion like? Basically, and then there's about a dozen questions, and there's generally a space in the question for a particular word that the person has brought up, or a concept. And the therapist will then incorporate that concept into the question, but the question's already fixed. They can't improvise, they can't add anything to it, because it's designed to prevent any kind of leading. So essentially the therapist doing absolutely nothing except listen and ask questions at key times that help to guide the patient's awareness deeper into whatever it is they're trying to explore. So that's at one end of the spectrum. It's as hands off as it can be without the therapist just saying nothing, right? As in, just you start talking and I'll sit here and take notes or whatever, and then after an hour, okay, you know, that obviously that wouldn't instill trust and very important is the instilling of trust. Okay, so then the other end of the extreme is a hands-on therapist who is, well, I mean, could obviously be bad therapy. It could be interrupting the patient, correcting them, telling the patient what they should think about certain things. Say if somebody says, my whatever it is, something, and oh, I really feel shit, you know, I blame myself for that. And the therapist says, you shouldn't blame yourself for that. You're not to blame. That's very hands-on. Because right. It's for the patient to discover. If the patient wants to blame himself, well, no. Whatever. It's like, that's a process that needs to be respected. And now, okay, but in the case of your therapist, it wasn't so much that you said that she was directing your feelings, but the fact that she was... only after three sessions was validating the idea that you were part of organized abuse, and then giving you stories or anecdotes that would reinforce. That's quite hands-on. It sounds like she's already decided that you're part of, you know, that you're a victim of organized abuse, and she wants to help you to concretize it.
Right.
Not saying that's a bad thing or a good thing, but it definitely could go either way. So what are your feelings about this person as a person? Like, if so far as you can separate the therapeutic methods and techniques and all that from that, your actual felt experience of her as a human being.
As a human being, yeah. I think she's well lived. I think she's pretty at peace with herself. She's kind of sliding into being a senior citizen, and I think she's experienced a lot in her life, and I think she's very, very careful about how she does her job. I think she cares about what she does. I mean, I know these are all pretty generalized things that I'm saying.
Does she seem like a warm person to you?
Very much so. Very, very warm person. But even to put a little distance between that, just to give it a real generalized thing, I don't think she's surprised by much. You know, I think she's seen a lot of real, real, real crazy shit. And just somebody being grounded is her main goal. Like, because she mentions that a lot, about somebody just being grounded and able to experience the life through their own eyes, mm-hmm. you know, or through their own sense of self. That seems to be really important. And maybe that's her goal for herself. But I think, you know, she's very much a take it as it comes type of person.
Did you?
Not very much pretension whatsoever. I mean, if half of what her credentials and experiences are true, there's no air of pretense whatsoever. None.
And have you had thoughts or concerns such as I've voiced in this conversation during your time with her?
Yeah, all the time.
Yeah, and do you vocalize them?
Yes. To a certain extent, I have. Yeah. Mm. I always have those. I mean, ever since, you know, and they've become even more intense after I started doing research and learning more about myself, because you don't know, what my experience has been. I've been with good therapists that don't have the tools to deal with this. Number one. And then, like you said, there are therapists out there who are working for the other team, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I'm always worried about that.
Mm-hmm.
So the only thing I could do was go see her, have a couple sessions, knowing that I could walk out at any time and not come back.
Right.
And that just might be where I'm at in life, you know, where I got so desperate, I just couldn't take it anymore, you know. And that could be a scary place to be, because you might take anybody's word for it.
Mm-hmm. does she, I mean, what does she think or say about you being dissociative identity disorder, being you having it, whatever the correct expression is? I mean, how clear is she about that, and what do you think?
She's been really, really careful with that because she wanted to see, like you said, she cannot tell you, or she could. Let me put this the right way. She knows that it wasn't her place or ethical to just listen to me say, I think I have problems with dissociation or dissociative identity disorder. And she'd be like, okay, let's get started. Mm-hmm. You know, she needed to keep seeing me and see where I was at to give me a so-called diagnosis. And that took a while. It was actually our last therapy session that she gave me. From what she could tell, she said, I have a generalized dissociative disorder. She says she's not seeing multiples, but she says I have a generalized dissociative disorder.
Okay. So no multiples, right? So that's...
Not that she can tell. She said she doesn't want to... She has to see that come from me. She can't... Like you said, you can't encroach that on anybody, you know?
Well, you shouldn't. Yeah. And it's not therapy if you are, but of course the other team that we're talking about, that's exactly what they'd be doing. I mean, they would be, if you or I were multiple, then that's the thing that they would be taking advantage of in order to handle us, so that they could, whatever, they put us into another multiple, give us our instructions, and then bring us back. We'd have no memory of it. Right. So in that sense, going to a therapist at all, if one suspects one might be multiple, is highly risky.
Right.
But then everything's risky if you're multiple. I mean, working in a thrift store is risky for me. Like, somebody could just come in and wave the hand signal, and, you know, I don't think I'm multiple myself. I don't think Alison... She's been non-committal because, I mean, we haven't even had a therapy session. So I'm not even sure what Alison would say in my case. I think maybe you and I have talked about this before, I'm not sure if we have, but that being so-called multiple isn't necessarily as cut and dried as it once was.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think we touched on that, and that reminds me of something interesting that she said. Was like, she did tell me a story about how they could spot the people that were faking.
Faking what?
Faking multiple personality disorder.
Right.
And she said in her experience, and this kind of relates to what you're talking about, is that the people that were, she used the word flamboyant, the ones that were very flamboyant about it, where they would switch into these giant grand personalities, like, you know, and maybe in the span of a few hours, they would be this completely different person. And then they would go to this and go to that. And they realized that over time, because like she kept saying, we were blind. We were just working with what we had. They were learning as they went, was that it is a lot more subtle than people realize. It's not you going, a lot of times it's not like one day you're Joe and then the next hour you're Susan. And there is some of that, but there's a lot more of these very, very subtle changes in people.
Yeah.
And that makes it even more scarier for the person who's experiencing it.
Just going back to that point you just said about the fakers, what did she say, like, who would be faking it? Like, people, like, what was the reason for it?
They were just, a lot of times it could be your typical story of somebody who didn't want to deal with criminal charges. You know, somebody who might have been facing going to jail for a certain period of time and they just wanted to play crazy. You know, just like some guy playing crazy so he didn't have to get drafted. You know, and some people were really good con men, you know.
Right.
So to you know, the I don't know all the experiences, but it could have been something as simple as that. Like they just wanted to, you know, get checked into a mental home because it would be easier than jail.
Right. Okay. I was thinking something else. It didn't occur to me, the most obvious reason.
But it could be what you're thinking about too. Who knows, you know?
Well, it was a bit vague. I mean, I was thinking, well, it doesn't matter actually. So one thing Alison said to me was that, she generally needs to be able to look the person in the eye when she's talking to them to gauge how fragmented they are and to gauge if they're multiple, because that's one of the ways that she can detect if they've shifted.
Right.
I mean, she didn't say more. She didn't give me her, you know, tricks of the trade exactly, but... Cool. I mean, I wrote a novel actually a year or two ago about multiple, not only, but that was part of what it was about. And so that gave me an opportunity to try and get my head around that. Like, what would it be like for somebody who is multiple and who didn't know it? And what, you know, what were the implications and what were the kind of, and how could I relate to it? You know, what were the closest things that I could relate to or use as experiences that related to that? And because you know, I mean, one of the things I incorporated into the novel was Whitley Strieber's account of how he experienced, you know, probably bullshit knowing Whitley, but anyway, it's a good science fiction, it was good in my novel. He experienced like being in an apartment, and he was standing in the room, and then the next thing he knew, he was on the other side of the room, and he looked over, and 2 hours had passed, and then it kept happening. He kept sort of hopping, jumping around in space, because basically what he was describing was missing time experience, right, like with a continuity of consciousness, where it was total blackout, and then he came back with no memory of being gone. So it was, right, whatever. It was a pretty interesting. I mean, that is a concrete description of what it could be like if it was literally, you know, your memories get wiped out. Now, needless to say, I've never had an experience like that, but what I do have many experiences of is, you know, lost objects. Just yesterday, I found my dressing gown on the hanger, and I never hang my dressing gown on the hanger. I've got a hook on the wall for it. So I said to my wife, "Oh, why is my dressing gown in the hanger?" And she didn't know anything. She denied it. Could be gaslighting, of course, early phase. And so I had to figure, I must have put my dressing gown on the hanger, just not thinking, you know, acting
right
mechanically, whatever. But it's not habitually. It's because I don't do, well, whatever. Anyway, so there's countless anomalies. I mean, that's more anomalous than usual. But there are countless anomalies in life that could be clues to this, you know. And the point being, if any, is that in terms of our consciousness and our awareness, we're constantly moving in and out the whole time, right?
Right. I believe that. I believe there's a natural element to that. But when it goes to the level of trauma, I would suppose a different thing starts to happen. The balance gets tipped and things get thrown off. And again, I'm no expert, but like you're talking about with like missing time, that was a question she asked me a lot. You know, she, every session for a while, do you have any experiences with missing time for long amounts of time? Because there are people who, you know, don't realize how they ended up sitting in the closet for 5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that kind of stuff. And like you're saying, that kind of thing never, ever happened to me. I think I've experienced small levels of missing time. But again, how much is that just a natural human condition? And how much of is it a condition of what I was traumatized by?
Well, yeah, I mean, when you... that's my camera went again. That's the wind. when you were saying that it's... a natural condition to go in and out. I mean, I didn't mean it as a natural thing. It may be, who knows, but we don't have a, you know, we don't have that control of, here's the natural man over here, let's ask him what his experience is like, right? So no, I was meaning that kind of going in and out that we do all the time, I wasn't meaning it's natural, I was meaning that itself is a symptom of trauma, that we're constantly dissociating, minds wandering, you know, our attention gets trapped by stuff.
Right, right. Yeah.
And so then we don't notice.
It's natural.
Yeah. So, like, I would say I'm somebody who pays really close attention to, in a particular sort of way, like constantly checking. So, for example, I used to have a thing when I would read a book. I couldn't stop myself from checking the page number every page.
Wow.
And it would ruin, you know, it would interfere with my being able to read the book because I was trying to stop doing that. And it was, so I got this part of me that's just compulsively checking. This is probably symptomatic itself, actually. And I would say that applies to time as well. Like, I'm not that I don't even wear a watch, so it's not like I'm literally always checking the time, but I'm pretty much, you could ask me pretty much any time during the day what time it is, and I would probably know within 15 minutes or half an hour or something. I tend to keep a really close watch on the time for whatever reason, because of this kind of compulsive quality in myself.
Do that all the time.
For checking. You do.
I used to, yeah. Yeah. I used to do that a lot. I must have grew out of it. That's maybe, I would always know, like, within a 15-minute realm. You're like, oh yeah, yeah, you always know what time it is.
Right.
That's crazy. That is great.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's especially because it wasn't like I had a job or the went often, but I mean, like, I'm someone who loves to lose track of the time. Like, I see that as a, that I've become a bit more free, and I've loosened up, I relaxed, it got spontaneous, and I just, time just flew away from me, because most of the time, no, I'm just constantly checking. Right. But that doesn't mean, of course, that I don't fail to check when, you know, when I dissociate. Right? It's probably compensatory.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, and I remember there was a few years where I used to drive people crazy. You know, I wouldn't trust myself for the time being right. You know, like, did I set my watch right? And then I would try to find a clock on the street. Then I would ask somebody, and they'd be like, you just asked me what time it was 3 minutes ago. I'm like, oh, okay, I thought an hour went by, you know? That's some wild shit. That's some crazy shit.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Whoa, baby. Please come on back. Oh, you got something of mine. I sure do like that's my black Cadillac in the morning. My black Cadillac in the morning. Yeah, my black Cadillac with them white wall ties.
That's the end of the first part of this conversation. Second part will be up next Saturday. I can't give dates and stuff because I'm on the road, and I'm just going to do the best I can to make sure that you get a podcast at least once a week while I'm traveling. I also can't thank donators by name for the same reason, but thanks to you, those of you who have donated. If you want to support the podcast, you know how to do it. Autoculture.com/liminalist.
About to make it real. That thing wide open. My black Cadillac. Help me in after some I shoot in the leg.
sure do like, and that's my black Cadillac. My black Cadillac in the morning. Yeah, my black Cadillac. With them white wall ties and hear what she told me. I know your Cadillac is really black. I know you got the white wall ties. But I got a black man beside. White eyes and white teeth. Ooh, lightning. You can't catch me. No, lightning. You can't catch me. Well, it's up yesterday now. Wonder where can it be? I stopped parking lot. Dead and parked in the Buster block. I caught him. But what good it do? That Cadillac wouldn't run no more for me. And it wouldn't run for you.